However, so far the administration has not taken affirmative actions to move that conversation forward and to work towards actually amending or repealing the AOMF. So what has Congress done? I'll preface this by saying this is prior to the crisis that's happening right now in Iraq and Syria. We'll get to that in a second. But before that, members of Congress have attempted to force votes to sunset or repeal the AOMF. Barbara Lee, of course, introduces a bill every year to repeal it. For the past 2 years, Congressman Adam Schiff of California has introduced amendments to large military authorization bills that would sunset the AOMF. These amendments did fail, but the vote count is really astonishing. Between the two votes together, 210 members of the House of Representatives voted in favor of repealing the AOMF. That's enormous. It was a bipartisan vote. Now, elections have happened and swept a few of those affirmative votes out, and they didn't vote at the same time, weirdly enough. But 210 total members of Congress voted to repeal the AOMF. It's enormous. The calculus is much different now, though. The midterm elections did sweep out a few of those members who voted for AOMF sunset, and the atrocities happening in Iraq and Syria with regard to the extremist group known as ISIS, ISIL, the Islamic State, Daesh, I don't know what else. Regardless of the name, this surge in violence prompted a new U.S. military campaign in the region, and this is really important. The president did not come to Congress before beginning this bombing campaign. He said he already had legal authority, and you can probably guess what it is. That's right, he cited the 2001 AOMF as justification for yet another military campaign. I think this is evidence that the AOMF will continue to be stretched and used for new things as long as it remains with us. So now, as you may have heard in the President's State of the Union address the other night, there is potential for a new AOMF. Many members of Congress, and now the President, are saying that there should be a new, more specific AOMF authorizing force against ISIS. This presents an important new opportunity to re-examine the 2001 AOMF. Let me tell you why. There could be a brand new AOMF, and it could serve as a new venue to address the old 2001 blank check AOMF. It could include a provision that repeals the 2001 AOMF or sunset in some way. It could include provisions that provide geographic boundaries, time limits, or more defined targets. This discussion is happening. It's happening right now. I'll leave you with an update on where this legislation is. At the very end of 2014, right before Congress went into their December recess, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee passed a new ISIS-specific AOMF. I encourage you again to go online, watch the video of the debate, because it is fascinating that after all this time, we are still having the same conversation. They went round and round in circles about how do we limit the president's authority, or if we should limit the president's authority. There were suggestions to provide geographic limitations, or explicitly state that this new authorization would not target associated forces. Those amendments were not adopted. However, a provision was included that would sunset this new AOMF and the old 2001 AOMF after 3 years. So I say all this to tell you two things. One, this is very much a live debate. Right now, as we're sitting in this conference, White House and congressional leaders are debating and are thinking through the future of war authority. They are going to have to make some hard decisions, probably in the upcoming year. We have an amazing opportunity to be a part of that process and to influence that debate. The second thing is that after all this time, it's amazing to me that we are still fighting the same fights and having the same conversations. When SFRC, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, couldn't agree to place boundaries on a new war, to ban the interpretation of associated forces, they're running the risk of making the exact same mistakes all over again with a new AOMF. There are moral questions at the heart of these issues. This community is uniquely positioned to provide a framework that bare law and policy by itself cannot address. I am so honored to be a part of this conference and look forward to working together on the future of the AOMF. Thank you so much for having me.
And we continue with another speaker from the same conference. This is Dr. Rush Holt, U.S. Representative for New Jersey for 16 years and the only Quaker in Congress. Let's hear how he got on and some of his key conclusions after, by his own admission, a pretty unsuccessful time at tackling the rise in the use of drones.
I'm not a lawyer. I used to play one on C-SPAN. I'm not an ethical authority. I do know something about drones, having watched firsthand. I should say I come at this with the general principle that organized killing is barbaric and sinful, but it goes on. And I should say, some say, well, yes, when we achieve the peaceable kingdom, then we can call these things barbaric and sinful. No, I think even short of that. But what I say is a little bit out of date. I'm no longer in Congress, and I left the Intelligence Committee some years before I left Congress. But I was there almost at the creation when shortly before I arrived in Congress that through an earmark, the Predator was purchased by the government from General Atomics. And I saw this carefully compartmented program. Most members of Congress did not know that these existed or that they could be or were being used for targeting people. I've traveled to Waziristan and Yemen and Afghanistan. I've talked with the teams, both in this country and abroad, that determine what the signatures are that they are looking for, that hour after hour monitor from these unseen drones the movement of the terrorist suspects. Now, I'll say a few words, this will be a little bit redundant and I can't do it really as well, about just war. But it's clear to me that although they call themselves war fighters, they are assassins. This is assassination of named people. Just because it's signature doesn't mean that it's not a particular person that they're going after. What they mean by signature is by observing the movement, observing the particular vehicles involved, they deduce where the person is. I found these people, some of them soldiers, many of them intelligence employees, probably GS-13 level, something of that order, I would guess, who think of themselves as professionals, but many of them are technicians more than soldiers, and they are careful in what they are doing to try to avoid children. They watch for that. They watch for others, but they cannot see the faces. At least what I observed, you could make out figures, but could not possibly distinguish one from another. These are flying very high. It's quiet. In fact, they fly so high that often there is no signature of the drone heard on the ground. So whatever happens is truly out of the blue, which I think brings a measure of terror to the occurrence, to the assassination then. Because you can't really see the individual, you are using a kind of profiling that is, well, it is, Bishop, I would say, profiling, and it is circumstantial. So you have to ask whether this fits with any sort of just war or just assassination theory. I think, I'll leave that to others to sort through. The fact that it is covert, for a long time, the very existence of the program was covert, adds, I think, an important moral dimension. It is much more acknowledged now, and the president has effectively acknowledged the use of drones. And as we knew even before that, he has embraced the use of drones. Because it's covert, I mean, there's a certain arrogance and foolishness in our covert programs. The United States intelligence community uses covert programs a lot. Seems to me they should be very, very rarely used. Because if they come to light, the negative reaction can do more damage than one could gain in the process. And they always come to light. I mean, I've called senior, you know, up to the director of national intelligence and the director of CIA and any number of other people before my committee when I was a chair, and asked them to give me a single occurrence of a covert program that did not come to light eventually. And they said, well, such and such. And you know, and they'd say, well, no, they're really risk. And I said, well, what about this program? They said, well, we denied that. So it didn't come to light. But it really is a different degree of violence, or if you want to call it warfare, if it is not out in the open, if it is not through a military chain of command, if it is out of the blue, as this surely is. It got started because of a fascination with technology. This is gee whiz stuff. It really is. I mean, I've looked at these planes, and up close, they're nice gadgets. And when you see a room full of screens showing the camera view from several different angles in many different places at the same time, it's impressive. And members of Congress, some of them were, I think, pleased to be read into the program and then fascinated by the technology and did not exert any significant oversight about it. Now, I was appalled. I was frustrated about my inability to do anything about it. But that's pretty much true with my attempt to bring oversight to any part of the intelligence activities of this country. I realize this is not supposed to be a confessional of my shortcomings, but it is in this area in particular, when I quizzed these, as I say, well-meaning teams of assassins about how what they really thought of what they were doing, it was complete miscommunication. It would take them many hours or days to get into a frame of mind to be able to engage in the discussion that's going on here. They were not asking any of the fundamental questions about this. They were there to take out the bad guys. They would say that in many cases, although they usually as a team were making the decision. By the way, originally when these were used at first, the authorization to pull the trigger on the Hellfire missile was made at a very high level. With familiarity with the technology, it has devolved to lower levels now. But they would feel that they would take some consolation in realizing that this is a team decision, whom to target and whether the person on the camera, in the camera's view, is that intended target. And they feel that that is a necessary step in the war on terror, or to use a little better English usage, the war on terrorism. It's a direct outgrowth of the authorization of the use of military force, the AUMF. So if you want my sense of where we should be heading to be more effective than I have been up to this point in bringing any control over this to stop its expanded use, we should look at the AUMF. We should look at the phrase war on terror. Because the traditional standards of war fighting have not been applied for the last 10 years, we have gotten into some indefensible positions, including assassination by drone. So I don't know how to do it, but if we can change the public mind about the difference between war and crime and punishment, we would have a chance of bringing this under some control. On the Intelligence Committee, I fought a losing battle for, 8 years or however long I was on there, to stop my colleagues from using the term war, because it was through the use of war that they led themselves into the kind of thinking that allows this to happen. So I did successfully pass in the House, but not get enacted, limitations on the purchase or use of lethal drones, armed drones within the United States. Of course, some of my colleagues said, why in the world would you need to prohibit that? It hasn't been used, to my knowledge, yet, but I think it is worth looking at. But I don't think that through laws or regulations restricting the use of drones, we will get anywhere until we get at the root of the problem, which is whether this is war or not.
And again, we return there to the issue of terminology. How convenient it is for governments to have a disparaging, highly disparaging label, terrorist, which they can apply to other people, but which is never applied to them. Like the idea of kidnappings by a national government, not being kidnappings, but being extraordinary rendition, the term which itself suggests it's quite extraordinary, whereas it's extra legal, i.e. illegal. If we're going to apply the idea of laws, then let's apply them uniformly. Let's have government employees who break laws just as liable as non-government employees. Of course, that's the theory. The practice increasingly seems to be going by the board. That, perhaps, is the takeaway message from this program. There's some very obvious failure to apply any type of legal framework that I can see in practice, and increasingly even in theory. This is, of course, a highly dangerous procedure by nation states if they wish to maintain any type of moral authority, to fail to bother with niceties such as following their own laws. Now, another speaker from the same conference, International Legal Director of Human Rights First, Gábor Rona, gives us an overview of the legal status of assassination by drone. He, too, begins with the issue of labels and notes a direct action campaign by people in Pakistan targeted by drones to try to challenge these labels and overcome the distance between them and their would-be assassins.
In drone operator lingo, a strike, a hit, is known as a bug splat. Maybe you've heard that before. In Pakistan, people have taken to constructing humongous photographic images of children, large enough so that they can be seen from very high up in the air by a drone, with a caption saying, "This is not a bug splat." Now, that image is not about whether the war is just, but about whether the means of fighting it is just. And we can agree, as Representative Holt said yesterday, that the struggle against terrorism needs to be recast in the language not of war, but of crime. In fact, quite interestingly, the French, because of their language peculiarity, have the ability to say something quite different about the struggle against terrorism than we do. In French, it's called the lutte contre terrorisme, and lutte means struggle. Perhaps a much more apt representation of what we are dealing with and what we have to deal with than war. However, even if we do agree with Representative Holt that this needs to be recast, that's largely a matter of policy and not so much law. So I will talk now about law because that is the language of those that are in charge of the policy. And I suspect that you're not going to like a lot of what I'm going to say about the law. Killing is not illegal per se in war, in armed conflict. And it's also not illegal per se in some situations outside of armed conflict. For example, in self-defense, or when a police officer kills a fleeing felon. So, you might disagree with that as a matter of policy, as a matter of morality, but I'm talking about the law. I'm not supporting the law. I'm not defending the law. I'm telling you what the law is. And it's important to know it, as I said, because that is the language of the policymakers. Killing is not illegal per se in war. And this has several consequences to some of the things that we've already been discussing and hearing about since last night and today. Kill lists. According to international law and domestic law, there is nothing per se unlawful about knowing the name of the person that is being killed in an armed conflict. Signature strikes. There is nothing per se unlawful about killing somebody on account of their conduct as opposed to their identity, of course, depending on what their conduct is. Collateral damage. There is nothing unlawful per se about civilian casualties in armed conflict. And it is important to understand the minutiae, the details of all of these separate and related facts of law in order to be able to advocate effectively, I believe, against the use of targeted killing. I want to spend the rest of my time talking about the two major legal, international legal frameworks that apply to targeted killing. One is the law of armed conflict, and the other is human rights law. And the differences between the two on questions of targeting are significant. In an armed conflict, you can legally target enemy combatants, members of enemy armed forces, and even civilians who are directly participating in hostilities, but only while they are directly participating in hostilities. That is the law of armed conflict. It's a rather broad killing authority. Outside of armed conflict, it's human rights law that applies exclusively. And human rights law has a much narrower scope of permissibility to killing. It can't be said that you may not kill people outside of armed conflict. Human rights law provides that lethal force may only be used when necessary to protect against an imminent threat to life that cannot otherwise be ameliorated. So even outside of armed conflict, the law foresees and permits killing extrajudicially under some circumstances. But the difference between the law of armed conflict paradigm and the human rights law paradigm is extremely significant. And therefore, it is also extremely significant and critical to be able to distinguish between whether killing is being done in an armed conflict or outside of an armed conflict. And this is one very significant area in which the United States, in the extent to which it has, through its authorities, explained its practice and explained its policy, has left us very much in the dark. And it has left us in the dark, I suppose, quite intentionally. Because to either confuse or conflate or fail to distinguish between what is claimed to be armed conflict authority and what is claimed to be outside of the realm of armed conflict enables the United States to operate in a gray area. And it is important to those of us who are advocating against targeted killing, I think, to be able to specify and to demand of the policymakers to tell us precisely, are you or are you not using law of armed conflict authority for your targeted killing in Yemen? If you are, who are we at war against there? And if you're not, then tell us precisely why you believe that the people we are killing in Yemen
represent an imminent threat to the life of Americans that cannot be ameliorated otherwise. And while we don't know a lot about facts on the ground, there have been quite a few studies that have attempted, and with some success, to determine that whether or not we are in an armed conflict situation in a particular place can be determined. And if we are in an armed conflict situation in a particular place, whether or not the individuals who have been targeted are or are not members of enemy armed forces, are or are not directly participating in hostilities at the moment of their death. And if it's outside of the realm of an armed conflict, there have been investigations that have quite clearly shown that a lot of the people who have been targeted may or may not have been, and in particular, many of them have not been representing an imminent threat to the life of Americans. And even if arguably they have been, that there were many circumstances in which those individuals readily could have been arrested rather than eliminated. These are the kinds of details that I think it is necessary for those of us who want to be advocating against targeted killing to be able to hone in on, in order to have useful conversations with those in power. I recall when Jay Johnson, who is now the head of Homeland Security, he was chief legal counsel in the Pentagon before he took this job. And I had a conversation with him about drone strikes. And his major talking point that I think he was most proud of was that, well, in the Defense Department, in the Pentagon, in our military operations, we always follow the law of war. He considered that to be a defense of the U.S. government's practices. I consider it to be an admission of violation of the law. And the reason is simply that not everything that the military does happens in the context of armed conflict. There are specific rules to what constitutes an armed conflict under the law of war, and it is not because the U.S. has declared war against either Al-Qaeda or terrorism more broadly. It is not because military means are being used. Rather, it's because there are either severe or intense or frequent hostilities between two armed entities that each have a command structure capable of applying the laws of armed conflict, whether they choose to do so or not. That's what constitutes an armed conflict. And if those criteria are not met, then you have no business, either proudly or otherwise, stating that you obey the laws of war. In those situations where the laws of war don't apply, then it is the less permissive rules of human rights law that limit who can be killed. In addition to this question of is it or is it not war, is it or is it not armed conflict, even within armed conflict, a serious dispute occurs about the propriety of targeted killing as to the specific targets. Is it or is it not a combatant? Is it or is it not a civilian directly participating in hostilities at the moment of their targeting? If you read a lot of newspaper accounts of targeted killing strikes, there are several words that you're bound to come up with rather regularly, like militant, like terrorist, like insurgent, like enemy, and my favorite one, bad guy. And you very rarely come up against the term combatant, but even when you do, it's used colloquially. There is very little in the journalism that we see in connection with targeted killings that even considers addressing whether or not the individual being targeted is in fact targetable. And as long as the general language of targeted killing continues to be focused on terms like militant, insurgent, terrorist, etc., it is creating an assumption and a false impression
that anyone who may fall within those general and hard-to-define terms is conceivably targetable. And that's a flaw of journalism. But it's also a flaw of, I think, many of us who fail to distinguish the utility, who fail to apply or fail to know the law that is actually applicable to whether or not a killing is lawful under international rules. The question of civilian harm is another area in which the vocabulary, I think, fails us. We tend to hear and talk a lot about collateral damage and civilian harm. Civilian as opposed to what? Civilians as opposed to combatants. Well, as soon as you're talking about civilians and as opposed to combatants, you're talking about armed conflict. And once again, whether or not the rules of war apply to a particular targeted killing scenario is rather questionable. So while it's very difficult to get away from the terminology of civilian deaths, again, it is important, I think, for those of us who are doing advocacy in this area to understand when we use the term civilian, we actually create a risk of conflating war and non-war. Because as soon as we use the term civilian, we are implying a contradistinction between those people and combatants. Outside of armed conflict, you don't have civilians and combatants. Outside of armed conflict, everyone is a civilian. And so the use of the term civilian, while I have to admit it's very difficult to get away from, is something that we have to be very careful about. Even within the realm of armed conflict, the concept of civilian casualties is most often referred to in connection with people who were not intended to be killed, but were nonetheless killed in connection with an attack against someone who was intended to be killed. That's the concept of collateral damage. And whether we like it or not, the law of war contemplates and accepts the notion of collateral damage with the caveat that it has to be proportional to the military advantage gained in an attack. Again, this is a law of war framework, and it has no business being used outside of armed conflict. Now, even within armed conflict, this frame, though, neglects one very significant category of people who are killed and shouldn't have been killed. When you talk about collateral damage, the reference is, as I said, to people who you didn't want to kill, but you perhaps knew were going to be killed in connection with an otherwise lawful attack, and that is lawful under the laws of armed conflict so long as the civilian harm is not disproportionate to the military advantage gained. But the one larger area of casualties that shouldn't have occurred that this formula neglects is the people who were intended to be targeted, but whose targeting was a violation of international law. So these newspaper accounts that talk about terrorists and militants and insurgents being killed, and the assumption that I think most people make when they read those terms is, well, those were legitimate. If, in fact, they were insurgents, terrorists, militants, then targeting them is legitimate. No. Targeting in an armed conflict is only legitimate against a member of the enemy armed forces or a civilian directly participating in hostilities at the moment of targeting. And I submit that the category of individuals wrongfully killed by targeted killing that consists of what we call pure collateral damage, in other words, individuals unfortunately but knowingly killed in connection with a lawful attack, is a much smaller category than the category of individuals intentionally targeted in violation of international law. So what I want to leave you with are essentially these three concepts. One, the importance
of distinguishing between what is and isn't war in accordance with definitions and distinctions in international law, because when it's law of war targeting, then the lawful power to kill is much broader than when it isn't war. The difference between the application of law of armed conflict, which has a broad targeting authority, on the other hand, human rights law, which has a much narrower targeting authority. The difference between what is and isn't war. Number two, the difference between what is and isn't a combatant. Do not accept terminology like militant, terrorist. Recognize and go forth with advocacy that hews to the concepts of international law, which narrowly define who may be targeted in an armed conflict as individuals who are members of enemy armed forces or civilians directly participating in hostilities. That's it. And finally, in connection with the concept of civilian casualties, I believe it's important to recognize and use in our advocacy the fact that it is not only women and children and old folks that constitute what we call collateral damage, but that there is also an even more significant number, I believe, of individuals who are wrongfully being targeted because they are falsely considered or falsely named to be targetable under the laws of war, even when they're not. Thank you.
And we conclude with Wendy Patton from the same Drones Conference on what little is known about the guidelines produced by the US government themselves. Decide for yourself to what extent that is a serious effort by people of principle, to what extent a mere window dressing.
I'm going to follow up on the discussion we've been having with Kavor and with Elizabeth about legal issues around drones, the international legal framework, and then Elizabeth was beginning a long discussion about domestic law focusing on the AUMF. What I want to do is talk about the way in which the administration has been interpreting those legal authorities with a particular focus on some presidential policy guidance. And I want to talk about what we know about that guidance. I'll walk you through what it says. And then what are some of the questions that are still unanswered about what are some of these legal interpretations and the way that they're being applied. So let me start off with the presidential policy guidance. This is guidance that was announced in May of 2013 when the president gave an important national security speech at the National Defense University. He talked about other issues like re-engaging in the effort to close Guantanamo. He talked about, relevant to what Elizabeth was just saying, the notion of the war against Al-Qaeda, and he said that this war, like all wars, must end. But he also talked about drone strikes and how drones are being used and some of the ways in which the administration has tried to put a framework on the way it's using drones and some constraints on it. So let me tell you a little bit about that guidance. Its full title I'll give you so that if you want to look it up, what we have is a two-page summary of the guidance. The guidance itself is a classified document, but there's a two-page fact sheet. And the full title of that fact sheet is U.S. Policy Standards and Procedures for the Use of Force in Counterterrorism Operations Outside the U.S. and Areas of Active Hostilities. The president in his speech talked about the issue this way. He said, America's legitimate claim of self-defense cannot be the end of the discussion. To say that a military tactic is legal or even effective is not to say it is wise or moral in every instance. For the same human progress that gives us the technology to strike half a world away also demands the discipline to constrain that power or risk abusing it. And that's why over the last 4 years, my administration has worked vigorously to establish a framework that governs our use of force against terrorists, insisting upon clear guidelines, oversight, and accountability that is now codified in this Presidential Policy Guidance, or PPG. So let's take a closer look at the PPG or at this fact, at this two-page summary that we have of it. What I'm going to do is go over a few of the key points and then talk about some of the questions that remain. So first of all, as you can tell by the title, which talked about the use of force in counterterrorism operations outside the U.S. and areas of active hostility, by its terms, it applies only to actions outside areas of active hostilities. So that's relevant to what Gabor was describing in terms of the laws of war. When we're talking about a zone of active combat, this guidance doesn't apply. In that setting, drones can be used according to the laws of war like other weapons. They have to comply with the laws of war and some of the principles that Gabor articulated, like the principle of distinction, distinguishing civilians from combatants, and proportionality. But they're used according to the laws of war. This guidance is meant to apply, again, outside of areas of active hostilities. So we'll think some more about that. What we see here is that the concern of many human rights groups is with the very use that's covered by the PPG, the use of armed drones away from traditional battlefields, where states target individuals who are believed to pose an imminent threat from long distance and in secret. And thinking about how this new drone technology may make this particular use of lethal force more possible. Now, the PPG states right up front that the U.S. government has a preference for capture. So it's U.S. policy not to use lethal force when it's feasible to capture a terrorist suspect. It also sets out some standards for the use of lethal force, beginning with two overarching principles. One, that this lethal force is not to be used as punishment or as a substitute for prosecution. And second, lethal force, drone strikes, are only to be used to prevent or stop attacks against U.S. persons, and even then, only when no other reasonable alternative is available to address the threat effectively. So those are the two overarching principles that are set forth in this PPG. Then it articulates that lethal force can be used outside areas of active hostility only when the following criteria are met. And here they are. First, there's a legal basis for using lethal force. Second, lethal force can be used only against a target that poses a continuing imminent threat to U.S. persons. Third, then there are some more specific criteria that have to be met. Near certainty that a terrorist target is present. Near certainty that non-combatants will not be injured or killed. That capture is not feasible at the time of operation. That the government or country in question cannot or will not address the threat effectively, and that there's no other reasonable alternative to address the threat effectively. The guidance also emphasizes that the U.S. will respect international law on the use of force in foreign territories, and there they're referring to the question of state sovereignty, that they will respect the sovereignty of the state on whose territory they are acting. And then finally, the guidance notes that if the U.S. is targeting a U.S. person, so that is typically used to mean a U.S. citizen or a lawful permanent resident. In that case, they will do additional legal analysis to ensure compliance with the Constitution and the laws of the United States. So that's what's set out in this two-page summary of the Presidential Policy Guidance, or PPG. So what are some of the things we still don't know about it, or what are some of the questions that we have about its meaning? Well, we've talked about how it applies to areas outside of active hostilities. So where then does the PPG apply? Which places in the world are considered areas of active hostilities and which are not? Elizabeth talked a little bit about that when she talked about where the AUMF might apply or not. How does that intersect with how they think about active hostilities in terms of whether this guidance covers the use of drone strikes? Well, probably not Afghanistan. Certainly not through till the end of last year where we were involved in combat in Afghanistan. Has that changed with the end of combat operations there? Well, some recent reporting suggests that even with the formal end of U.S. combat operations in December, Afghanistan continues to be considered an area of active hostilities, at least for much of this year. And that seems to be both about the nature of what's happening on the ground there and also the nature of the continued presence of U.S. forces there through this year. So this PPG probably doesn't apply in Afghanistan. And so again, what does that mean? It means they're following the laws of war in terms of engagement, not these specific rules. What about Pakistan? Well, it's hard to say. But We can assume that it probably follows a similar course and will be treated the same way as Afghanistan, at least the areas of Pakistan that are near the Afghan border, because those have tended to be seen as part of the Afghan theater of war. And there's also a force protection rationale that it is there's a need to protect U.S. forces fighting in Afghanistan from cross-border attacks. So, and again, there's some recent reporting that suggests that these questions are likely to go in parallel. But we don't know for sure because the use of drones in Pakistan is not something that's publicly acknowledged. What about Iraq and Syria, right, in the current fighting there against ISIL? Does the PPG apply to drone strikes there? No, it does not. That is because it's clearly an area of active hostilities, and the White House affirmed in the fall that because it's not outside of active hostilities, but rather it is active hostilities, that the PPG would not apply there. What about Yemen or Somalia? Well, we don't know for sure. The administration has not stated clearly whether it's following the rules of the PPG there, or rather it's following the laws of war that govern drone strikes. And in Yemen, as with Pakistan, the U.S. government doesn't acknowledge or discuss the use of drones. So it leaves us with some questions about, we've got this set of rules that is meant to constrain the use of drones away from recognized battlefields, away from where, as Gabor described, the laws of war apply to the use of lethal force. But we don't exactly know where in the world is it being applied. Another question we don't know is the meaning of some of the key terms that I was describing that are used in the PPG. One of them, and one that you'll hear more about today, but I want to flag for you now, is imminence. Gabor talked about how under human rights law, away from an armed conflict, states can use lethal force to repel an imminent attack if they don't have another alternative to address or remedy that threat. Well, the PPG uses the term continuing imminent threat. What does that mean? The term itself is not explained in the PPG, in the two-page summary. It may be explained in the full classified document, but it's not explained in the two-page summary that we have. So that raises some important questions about how expansive is this interpretation of the term imminence under international law. It seems, by using the term continuing imminent threat, to be referring to an unspecified adverse action at some undefined point in the future. But again, we don't know what this term means. And so how can we think about whether that term is consistent with the way we understand or other interpretations of the term imminence under international law? Another thing that I mentioned was this question of feasibility of capture and the preference for capture and to use lethal force only when capture is not feasible. Well, that raises questions about how is the feasibility of capture defined and how is it determined? We don't know. Another question is the criteria for being determined to be a lawful target. One criterion that we've just discussed is continuing imminent threat, and we've talked about what that means in the administration's interpretation. But how else is that determination made, that a specific person can lawfully be targeted, can lawfully be killed by a drone? The PPG, the two-page summary, says that there must be a legal basis for using lethal force, and it gives the example of a senior operational leader of a terrorist group or part of the forces of such a group. But again, how would they arrive at that conclusion with respect to a specific individual? These are questions that we don't know. And then even if they determine somebody may be a lawful target, how then do they reach the decision to go ahead and target them? How do they apply the criteria that is set forth in this document so that we can understand how someone is actually made the subject of a targeting decision? Another thing that we don't have is the number and identities of those who've been killed in drone strikes. We only know a few. One of the examples that the president actually spoke about in his speech at the National Defense University in May of 2013 was the strike against al-Awlaki, a U.S. citizen in Yemen. And he lists that al-Awlaki and I believe three other people were killed in that strike. That information was declassified and spoken about by the president. But we don't have a full understanding of the numbers and the identities of those who are killed, which is important in so many ways, both for knowing what is happening, for being able to assess the policy, and assess some of the questions that we've been talking about today. And then this is an important point. Even if we could answer all of our questions about this guidance satisfactorily, if we had more information and we could say, you know what, that is an appropriately constrained policy, or we think mostly they've tried to put some constraints on it that make sense, Another critical question is, how do we know if it's actually being followed in practice? You can have the right policy, but you have to follow it in practice. And of course, we don't have information about whether the standards they've set forth for themselves as constraints are actually being followed. And so much of that has to do with the amount of secrecy that surrounds the use of drones. So that is the PPG. I do want to take a minute to just note another way that we've learned some information about the U.S.'s legal interpretations of its authority to use drones, and that is from litigation. That will be discussed in more detail this afternoon, but I do want to note that that's another way. One way has been the information that the president has put forth in his speech and in this summary of this classified guidance. But another way, a source of information about these issues has been litigation. And it's a potential way of learning more about U.S. policy and practice. And the primary example here is the lawsuit around the Alalaki case. In that case, both the New York Times and the ACLU brought suit for disclosure of the government's legal opinion, which was the basis of the strike against Alalaki, who, as I mentioned, is a U.S. citizen. The Federal Court of Appeal for the Second Circuit ordered the release of a redacted version last year, and so the legal opinion was actually made public by the government in response to that decision. As you'll hear more about, this is about the targeting of a U.S. citizen only. So while it's really important that we know that and that information was released, it's obviously much narrower than it's much narrower a lens and much narrower than what's happening because the vast majority of people who are being targeted are not U.S. citizens. But still, I just wanted to note that that is another way we've learned something, and this legal opinion is out there and is something that you can read that gives us some insights into how they're grappling with these bodies of law that we've been discussing today, the law of war, the international law of self-defense, human rights law, and then domestic law that is related to these concepts. It's the AUMF, the authorization to use military force, and then other principles of constitutional law that would apply in the case of a U.S. person. So I want to turn now to talking a little bit about this question of transparency, what we don't know and what we need to know and why. And in particular, I want to focus on post-strike assessments and redress for harm. It's really important to place a focus on efforts to have less secrecy and more transparency when it comes to drone strikes. Doing more to assess strikes after they happen and to provide redress where it's warranted is not only a critical part of government accountability and a commitment to the rule of law, but it's also critically important in human rights and moral terms. If a strike caused harm to a civilian in armed conflict, or if the government unlawfully targeted someone outside of an armed conflict, that's really important to know. And doing an assessment gives the government an opportunity to try to make that right, or to at least do what it can to make amends. Now, even if the government may be resistant to making public some aspects of the policy, it should be willing to conduct much more thorough and meaningful post-strike assessments. And what's critical there is that they be more independent than they've been. They obviously shouldn't be done by the same people who were involved in the strike. And then to provide for redress. This is not unprecedented. The U.S. military offers compensation in the form of what are either called salacia or condolence payments, in armed conflicts for civilian harm. And the military has done that in the Iraq War and in Afghanistan. So this is an idea that could be extended, potentially, to drone strikes. Even the CIA director John Brennan, during his confirmation hearings in 2013, said this about strikes that happen outside of declared war zones. He said, "Where possible, we also work with local governments to gather facts and, if appropriate, provide condolence payments to families of those killed." Now, the challenge we face in talking about this issue, of course, is that drone strikes in Pakistan and Yemen are secret and not publicly acknowledged by the government. But it's something that they could do, and it's not unprecedented. And this is the beginning of trying to understand and assess what is the policy and is it being followed. And if they arrive at conclusions that either mistakes were made or that harm was caused, can they take steps to address that? So I just want to finish with this thought. When we think about the legal questions that we've been discussing today and how it applies to drone strikes, it's critically important to achieve greater transparency and accountability, both as a check on the use of this power and to ensure redress for civilian harm and unlawful targets. Opening up government action to scrutiny can help ensure drone strike policy is sufficiently constrained, that it complies in practice with domestic and international law, and it can help make the use of lethal force more accountable, both in terms of providing redress where it's warranted and in promoting public scrutiny. So how can we achieve greater transparency? Many human rights groups have been calling for that, and it has been a challenge. Well, I want to indicate one small ray of hope, and that has been some limited disclosure thus far of drone strikes conducted by the military in Somalia. In December, the Department of Defense stated that it had carried out a drone strike. It said when. It said it was against a senior operational leader of al-Shabaab. They gave his name, and they explained his role within al-Shabaab, and they said the region in the country where the strike had taken place. They had the Pentagon press secretary describe this strike, and then they put out a small press release. Now, this is a very small step, just a dipping of the toe in the water, but it is a start, and hopefully it's something we can build on in pushing for the government to disclose more, at least after the fact, about these strikes. There's another important potential change that we could try to make, and that is to transfer the authority to conduct strikes from the CIA to DOD so that the authority resides wholly with the Department of Defense and that the CIA is no longer involved in conducting strikes. This has been discussed for well over a year, but what first seemed to have some traction and an idea that might move now seems rather stalled. Putting DOD solely in charge won't solve the problem entirely. There's still going to need to be a push for transparency and accountability. But there's fairly widespread agreement that DOD is where the use of lethal force belongs in the first instance. And it's likely to be more transparent than if the use of drone strikes remains in the CIA. Another thing to consider is that we are approaching the end of the Obama administration. There are 2 years left. And as the president looks to his legacy and the authorities and precedents that he's going to leave behind to his successor, the president will likely want to ensure that the use of armed drones is appropriately constrained. And indeed, he acknowledged the importance of such constraints and of greater transparency and oversight in his speech in 2013. So now, at the end of the administration, presents an opportunity to advocate for achieving the goals that he laid out in that speech and to see that they're met by the end of his term. So I just want to close with two important thoughts for us to think about as we look to the future. One is that it's important to consider the precedent that the U.S. is setting in a world in which drone technology is proliferating. How will other governments use this technology against those they identify as threats? And how do we ensure this power is sufficiently constrained and transparent so that there can be accountability for the use of lethal force by states? That's what makes this discussion so important. And secondly, it's also really important to understand whether this drone technology and other kinds of technology that will surely follow will lower the barrier to the use of lethal force against individuals and what that means for a future where human rights, democracy, and peace can thrive. Thank you.
This and all previous episodes of Unwelcome Guests are available for download from MP3 Archive at unwelcomeguests.net. Our theme tune is by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Just like everybody.